received 200 gifts totaling $125,000. We plan to have the new transmitter up and running by early July. Thank you to everyone, those who donated to the campaign, and those who support the station day in and day out by volunteering and making membership contributions. It takes a lot to run a successful community radio station, such as reliable equipment, dedicated volunteers, and generous members. We all make WERU great, and if that's not enough, we're getting a new transmitter. Thank you.
Support for WERU comes from Inner Tapestry, Maine's holistic journal, celebrating and supporting life, featuring alternative health and natural living articles, calendar listings, and a directory of resources. Available at health food stores and alternative health centers, 799-7995 or innertapestry.org. Support for WERU also comes from Quantum Insulators of Belfast, serving Midcoast Maine as spray foam specialists, licensed dealers of the Isonine portfolio of spray foam products, including commercial and residential applications with renewable and recyclable content. More information at quantuminsulators.com or 338-3077.
It's 9:59 and you are tuned to WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online everywhere at weru.org, Common Ground Radio with your hosts from the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association is up next.
Good morning and welcome to Common Ground, an hour-long discussion of local food and agriculture and what's happening around the great state of Maine. My name is Cheryl Wixon. I'm from the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, and I'm joined in the studio this morning by two of my renowned colleagues that work here at MOFCA, Andrew Marshall and Dave Colson. And Dave, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. Yeah. This is the first time we've enjoyed to have you on the show.
It is. I've done a little radio down south. I live closer to Portland, so I've done a little bit down there, but this is my first time up here, so thank you.
Welcome. I think, actually, Dave's fairly new to us here at the staff at MOFCA, and maybe you might want to just fill folks in on what your role is here.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to be part of MOFCA. I joined the staff in August of last summer, and after spending 30 years on our farm down near Freeport in the town of Durham. And so my background is as a market farmer selling produce. We've done everything from CSAs to farmers markets to wholesale, growing a whole variety of crops, greenhouses, a little bit of livestock. So lots of pieces to juggle, and something I want to work with other farmers on to try and aid them in any way I can.
Well, great. I can say personally that's been a wonderful addition to have you around. It's a great source of knowledge. And Andrew, good morning.
Good morning, Cheryl. I'm Andrew Marshall. I'm MOFCA's Education Director. It's good to be back in the studio after a prolonged hiatus. Long winter away from the mic.
Yes, yes. But you've been busy teaching, and I'm sure no grass grows under your feet. So tell me, what's happening? What's going on around the state? I know this weekend a lot of farmers markets are opening up. This very exciting time of the year. I really enjoy this. And I've got asparagus actually popping up. And I've seen asparagus at the market. I've seen a lot of leafy greens. I've seen fiddleheads. What else is happening out around there?
A lot of things that people have had in their greenhouses. We've talked in Maine for a number of years about winter growing, but the neat thing about a sheltered growing, whether it be cold frame or greenhouse or even unheated covered spaces of some kind, is that little bit of augmentation. Once you get past the beginning of February and the light starts to increase, especially as you get into March and April, there's a whole lot of things that you can start and begin to eat, particularly the leafy greens are the fast one. And a lot of folks, especially the commercial farmers, organic farmers, are putting tomatoes into their greenhouses. Typically, if they're started and ready to go out by late March, early April or so, and then we can actually conceive of harvesting tomatoes in June.
That's pretty exciting in Maine.
It is.
Instead of those rock hard little, like, light pink things.
Yes, and our season can be so short that that few weeks in August or September we can enjoy, and the longer we can make those tomatoes go, the better.
Well, this kind of brings us up to the topic of our discussion today, is seedlings, mm-hmm. and talking about that. Is it too late to start seeds now?
It's not too late. A lot of things have been started, and what I like to do is kind of look at when I estimate my frost-free date to be. And where we live further in southern Maine, and we're only about 8 miles from the coast, I used to always plan on middle of May being my last frost date. And after keeping temperature and records and whatnot, weather records for many years, I've come to realize that 50% of the time I'm still looking at a frost danger by the 21st, 22nd or so. So I've kind of backed off by a week on how early I think I can put things in for frost. So that being said, there are certain plants that are what we call tender annuals. They don't handle frost at all. And those things need to really wait until the weather is settled, hence in Maine and all over New England, the typical planting date has always been Memorial Weekend for most folks. So if you find that last frost date, and if you want to be safe, let's say Memorial Weekend, you can count back the number of weeks. So counting back 4 weeks would be certain things like leafy greens, or if you were to transplant tomatoes or zucchinis or squashes, those are typically pretty fast coming up in trays or in seedling flats. For things that are a little longer, there are other things that take more like 6 to 8 weeks of time. We're getting past the point of being able to start those kinds of things, cabbages, broccoli, so on, if you're looking for an early crop. Now, a lot of those longer season things can also stay into the ground longer into the fall. So even though they take 8 weeks and we're looking at a frost-free date, there's still plenty of time to start those things and still get a fall harvest on a lot of those.
So if I'm a home gardener, or, you know, just starting out, then I need to look at this frost-free date, right, and then look at the length of time it's going to take my seeds to germinate.
Correct.
And how large, and how large they're going to be before they get set out.
Right.
So help me out on this one here, Andrew. Sort of sort this through for us. So types of things that only take 4 weeks are your leafy greens, our tomatoes, and mm-hmm. those types of things, okay? So I'm interested in this. I've got my seeds. Where do I begin if we're going to start with seedlings?
Yeah, just backing up for a sec to the timing and mm-hmm. sort of sorting out a planting schedule and when to start seeds. Johnny Selected Seeds has a really great little cheat sheet that's on their website, which is downloadable into kind of a spreadsheet format. And that would be a great place to start. Just one resource. There's a number of them out there,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and that takes the same approach. It asks you when your frost-free date is. You can plug that in, and then it has some macros and formulas embedded in it that'll actually help you.
Oh, cool!
To actually identify those dates.
Mm-hmm, nice. Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of them that are still coming up. I'm just looking at it right now, and so there's plenty of stuff that's still. Should be started inside for sure, especially given kind of the wacky weather that we're having these days and the lack of predictability that we're seeing as well. It's always a good idea to kind of remove some of that. Starting seeds indoors is a good way to remove some of that unpredictability and have a little bit more control over
right.
the environment.
Yeah, and with this kind of weather we've been having, it was so warm for so long there, it was very tempting. A lot of the garden centers were saying they had to talk people out of putting a lot of warm weather things in, and it's a good thing they were, because then we had this kind of weather move in, and you can have a lot of seedlings out there, but they aren't really going to grow below 40 degrees or so, and with all the cloudiness and rain and whatnot. And then the other danger, not so much for seedlings, but certainly for things directly seeded into the ground, are the cold temperatures, funguses, and an insect pest that's a type of maggot we call a corn root maggot. And it can actually hatch out in the ground and attack those pea or spinach seeds that are in the ground. So often folks will look and say, well, gee, I put these in when it was nice and warm, but I'm not getting much germination, and often it can be that maggot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if we've done our calculations, we've got our seeds, and we've got things that we can still start inside, what are some of the basics? What do we need to start with?
Well, the first thing you want to be thinking about is the medium that you're going to put the seedlings into, that you're going to start them in.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, it's kind of funny, typically we all call those mixes soil mixes, but actually the term for them is soil-less mixes, since they don't typically anymore contain soil within them. Now, in the conventional nursery business, they're basically using pretty much a sterile medium with a different kinds of peat or mosses in it, and usually something to loosen up the mix, like a perlite or a vermiculite.
That's those little white dots that I see.
Yeah, the little white dots, that sometimes look like styrofoam mm-hmm. beads.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually volcanic rock pumice that's been washed and used instead of sand. So the old mix, the old standard mix that folks can make at home as home gardeners if they want to, used to be one-third sand, one-third silt or garden soil, and one-third compost.
Mm-hmm.
And that will do fine. Often what happens with that soil part of the medium is that it can carry disease that will affect the seedlings or the seeds as they're just beginning to emerge. And what will end up happening is you'll stick the seeds in, the disease will be in the soil, and the disease actually begins to feed on the compost that we put into the soil. It uses it as an energy source. So it's not really attacking the seedlings per se. It's just building up a population within the soil, and the seedling just happens to be in the way, in a sense. It just gets consumed as well as the organic matter.
So if you're going to start your own home seedlings, you can either make your own mix, but you probably want to use material. Well, if you're going to use compost, wouldn't you want to use compost that's been reached the 135 degree stage, so it doesn't
right.
have any...
Yeah, so you're mentioning the organic, the certified organic needs for calling something a compost,
mm-hmm.
and that's that 131 to 135 degree for at least 3 days, and then a turning of the pile. Even with those kind of temperatures, you can still have pathogens in there. So the other aspect of a good compost for seedling production is that it be really well finished or aged.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not just a matter of meeting those temperatures and turning and a quick decomposition, but a good aging of a year or so to make sure that a lot of those pathogens have worked their way out. That's why on our farm we used to do our own mixes. We
mm-hmm.
would save soil and compost and all these pieces in containers, because obviously in January or February, when you're thinking about starting really early seeds,
you don't want to go out to the frozen compost pile and try to dig it up,
yeah,
right?
I have a great picture of years ago when I didn't have any of this put aside, and I think I dug a hole through 3 feet of snow and then chopped a hole in the ground to find the soil. But we did run into the pathogens in our soil and got really discouraged on making our own mix. And we thought about buying a sterilizing machine of some kind. You can use steam to sterilize, or you can actually bake the soil mix in the oven if you want to.
Put it in the oven, I can see that now, yeah.
Although, boy, it can make the house
very fragrant.
Very fragrant. So basically what a lot of folks have done is gone to these soilless mixes. And in the conventional world, what they have is a mix with these sterile and non-soiled and actually not compost in them as well. And usually there's a small shot of chemical fertilizer in the mix, so the pro-grow kind of things that you would find at garden centers. And then the nurseries will water on a daily basis with a chemical formula into the trays themselves. It's not a lot of fertilizer each time, but it gives the plants a little shot on a daily basis. And in some cases, they can actually tweak those different chemicals or different fertilizers that are in that to give the seedlings a really nice green color to them, say.
Mm-hmm.
And so often it, especially some of the, let me say, less scrupulous nurseries, you can get seedlings that just look very vibrant, but often don't really have the kind of root structure and health that we're really looking for in seedlings.
So that brings up a thought I'm having. We're talking about planting seedlings and starting, you know, from seeds. What type of containers? I mean, can I just get a great big pot, fill it with a soil mix, and throw in some tomato seeds? Or what type of containers? What do we need? What other types of equipment?
Anything you like to use, Andrew, particularly?
Well, when we were in California, we lived right down the road from the Speedling company. And Speedling, so backing up for just a sec, there is a good reason to pay attention to the type of containers that you're using when you're starting seedlings for a number of reasons. Most of them have to do with the ability to control sort of the variables and parameters that you're wanting to control when you're starting seeds. And so things like temperature, moisture, light, all those sorts of things. So there's a number of commercial products out there. People have seen them. Most of them are made of plastic, but there's a lot of farmers use just shallow trays that are made from softwood that's locally available, which is a good way to be able to really kind of have some control. Well, to fit a lot of stuff in a small space, right? That's a consideration. And then also be able to the extent possible, control the moisture and temperature that soil is at.
Husband built me some wooden trays, and I line the bottom with a newspaper and then reuse them every year.
Right. So the issue with having too deep a container is then that the soil doesn't warm up as quickly as you want it to. You could have issues with too much moisture or too little moisture. So it's about control. And then if you're wanting to start some of these heat loving crops like tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and such things like that, a lot of times you might want to actually deliver some supplemental heat to the base of those. And so a shallow container will obviously be much more efficient with delivering heat with something like a heating pad or sort of a seedling heat mat.
A heat mat, like, right, that.
Now,
is it recommended that you start the seedling in the thing that you're going to transplant it in? I start mine in, as I say, wooden flats and then transplant over into pots, but
we actually use a little bit different terms just to differentiate. So seedling or seed starting tray, and then moving it into another tray within the greenhouse we actually call pricking out.
Oh, really?
Pulling them out of the trays and moving them into something else. And then we call transplanting once they go into the field.
Okay.
For clarity.
To differentiate the different stages as we go.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. And one of the folks that I worked for years ago had a great way of thinking about it. He called those three stages breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
I like that. So breakfast is when you start in the
little tray. You're germinating your seedlings, and then lunch is their pod or larger cell area that you're putting them into, and then finally into the garden for dinner. So we do like to start our seedlings on a heated area of some kind. We have mats right now. Mm-hmm. We'd like to do a kind of a hot water bottom heat kind of thing, but haven't worked that. But regardless, a little heat, as Andrew mentioned on the bottom, really helps to get things out of the ground. And then you don't have to have the air in your greenhouse or house as warm when you are starting the seedlings. Like, if you can keep the soil medium around 70 degrees, then the air temperature can be 55 in the building, and they'll still germinate.
So you really wouldn't necessarily need to heat the greenhouse, per se, if you were providing a heat source to the bottom?
Certainly wouldn't need to heat the greenhouse as much. Okay. Of course, you wouldn't want it to freeze.
Right, yeah, so...
So then once the seedlings are up, we don't mind some density in the trays that we're starting things if we're going to pull them out, prick them out into other cells. Now, the wood flats are kind of where we started as well with our seedlings. And the one thing that I've found and the reason people have gone to these segregated kind of cell trays now that the plants are in is that those roots of whatever your seedling is, your tomato or your broccoli, in the wood flat, the roots would all kind of grow in together. And when you wanted to put it out in the field, you'd get out there with your knife.
You'd cut
them apart.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then you've done damage to that root system, and things will wilt. And when we used to do this 30 years ago, we would always try and transplant on a cloudy day or at certain times. But now with the cell trays, and Andrew was just about to mention the styrofoam speedling type tray. That's funny. I wasn't expecting you to say that one. That though, because those are the flats we use as well. Any kind of cell tray will do this. That you now have this really compact, or not necessarily compact, but solid root system that you can move around and transplant, and typically get very little wilting of those plants. So that's pretty much why people have gone to those type of trays.
And so another alternative, the idea of segregating each plant into its own little cell is to develop that sort of nice, robust root ball. That then makes things easier to transplant and prevents that transplant shock that Dave was talking about when you're really kind of manhandling the roots when they're all sort of intertwined together. And another strategy for doing that is not to use containers at all, but to use something called soil blocks. Dave, you want to talk a little bit about soil blocking?
Well, to tell you the truth, it's something I'm interested in but have never had much experience myself. Have you used them, Andrew?
Yeah, we have, and I know a number of growers that use them. And the idea is to sort of recreate the discrete package of that a seed gets to grow in, a la a segregated seedling tray. But not to use those materials, and so the seed will develop roots within its little soil block. But then, as the roots get to the edge of that, they will do what's called air pruning, which is they'll get to the edge of the soil. They'll realize that
it's over.
It's,
you got to stay within
a heck of a lot further, and they will then sort of develop a much more dense root mat that is then more robust to transplant. And so there are soil block makers, typical kind of commercial planting mix, just kind of wet it and it forms a kind of a brick. And they make different sizes so that one can pot on from a very tiny, half inch by half inch soil block into, 2 inch and then into even 4 inch. So that the issue of potting on is also taken care of as well.
I'd like to remind folks that you're listening to WERU, your community radio. We're 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor, and streaming worldwide at WERU.org. This is Common Ground, hosted by your friends, the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. I'm Cheryl Wixon, and I'm joined in the studio this morning with Andrew Marshall and Dave Colson. And we're talking about seedlings, and it's not too late to start. In a few moments, we're going to be taking your calls. But so you just said a word again to me, potting on. What does that mean?
I think that's kind of what I was talking about, pricking out.
Was the same thing?
It's a very similar term, kind of moving the plants on. And for some things, particularly like a tomato, we actually will pot it off two or three times before it actually goes out into the field.
Meaning that you'll keep pricking it or taking it from one size to the next to keep getting that root ball bigger and bigger. So why don't you just start in a big pot?
Right. Well, typically, as I was mentioning with the conventional way of growing seedlings, when you're adding that fertilizer, you keep giving the plants a shot. I find in the compost mixes, there's usually enough inherent fertility in that mix for 4 to 6 good growing weeks. And so if I'm going to keep something in there for 8 weeks, then
you're
probably going to want to pot it off.
Okay, I understand that. So in other words, it's just going to exhaust the resources that it has within that small piece of soil.
Right.
So you've got to keep moving it to another.
And if you've started in a small cell or a small pot, that root system of that, say, tomato plant can only get so big before it kind of fills up that space.
Mm-hmm.
And what will end up happening is physiologically the tomato will say, oh, ran out of room, I'm going to slow down for a while. And its metabolism will slow down to a certain degree. And you, if it becomes pot-bound like that, you can put it into another larger pot or a larger cell. But it's going to take a while for it to realize that it's in a pot bigger, so it slows down. And what we're trying to do for a lot of these seedlings is just like we try to do for kids, give them as much energy to grow as they can, and don't hold them back.
Give them the best environment.
That's right. So actually, one other thing I just wanted to mention, Andrew was talking a bit about is the peat aspect of some of these mixes, because these soilless mixes are heavily reliant on peat mosses.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two types that are typically used. One is called sphagnum moss, which is the typical, what folks think of as peat moss. It's a brown peat. And then there's another type called black peat that's actually made from sedge grass instead of sphagnum moss. And the characteristics that they have are somewhat different. And the soil block maker, from what I understand, seems to work a little bit better with some of the black peat in there. For some reason, it sticks together a little bit more. But there is concern over the peat reserves, because this is a renewable resource, but it's renewable almost like a fossil fuel over
thousands of years, right?
Not quite as long as that, maybe, but so a lot of the peat that we're using is coming out of Canada. The general notion is from the Canadian harvesters is that they're not harvesting faster than it's being made. I think one of the problems in the use of peat is in places in the world where it's actually being burned for the energy that's in it. And to me, the amount that is used in food production is relatively minuscule. And I think this is one of those cases of where should a resource appropriately be used, and I think it's good to be conscious of. And for folks that want to substitute something else other than the peat, there's people working on these coconut fibers called coir. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really used it much, but folks are finding it works pretty good. And another way to add some things into the flats to keep the soil loose is some good leaf mold. Letting the leaves break down almost till you have a kind of composted material and use that in your soil mix.
And that doesn't carry through any pathogens and bacteria that affect the
seedling? It has the potential to do that more than some of these other pieces, but as an alternative, it is another.
Now, a couple years ago, I visited a farmer that used worm castings.
Uh-huh.
He saved all winter in his basement. He was feeding his worms, and that's the material that he used for to start his seedlings with. Now, that doesn't would that not necessarily have the same bacterial pathogen concern that you would have out of compost from the outside?
Worm castings aren't heat treated.
Mm-hmm.
They are a different type of biological system, obviously. So I think, again, the dangers could be there, but in many circumstances, it would work just fine.
Yeah.
So, but the kind of the takeaway message here is that when you're making homemade seed mixes, there is certainly a concern to have something in that mix that that you don't want to have and that could pose some issues later. Either with problems with germination or just after germination, some issues such as damping off. Let's talk a little bit about, sort of troubleshooting at this stage. Let's talk a little bit about some of the stuff that's harder to germinate than others and what some of those issues might be, whether it may be temperature or moisture, things like that. And then some of the diseases or other kind of mysterious things that might happen. You go out and you're watering your seedlings and you notice that some of them are droopy and some of them are laying on the soil. What might some of those issues be?
There's some various things that can get started in that soil mix, and the damp off organism actually attacks the seedling right at the base of the plant, and kind of girdles it, and that's often when you'll see it kind of sadly lying over in the tray. And a lot of the control for damp off, since it's pretty much prevalent most of the time in either the air or the mixes, is kind of control of moisture. And that's where this weather we've had this last couple of weeks
must be hard.
Made it so difficult because you're trying to keep things moist enough for things to grow. But ideally, what I was taught was that you want the surface of the soil in the pot or the tray to not be dry, like completely dried out, but basically not too moist for overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that overnight, overly moist conditions that really can get that damp off started.
So that means basically when it's dark.
Yes.
Dark, too much
cloudy,
water. Too much water,
yeah.
Heavy air saturated with moisture, then we're going to have those kind of conditions.
Yep. So often on days like this, we'll make a judgment call in the first thing in the morning whether we want to water or not. And if we water, we just water early in the morning and that'll be it.
Mm-hmm.
So that they have some time to dry down by evening. And if it's a hot, sunny day, we'll water first thing in the morning and we'll water again at noon, again, trying to kind of let those trays dry out to a certain degree for the evening.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. I know we've had a long stretch of the wet weather, but let's say that, and I do this often, I'll start stuff in my greenhouse, I'll go in the morning to water, and then I'm off to work.
Right.
And then, I don't get back until, 6 o'clock at night. Those little guys might be all dried out.
Yeah, that's true.
And then if they don't get water, they're just going to keel over from that situation. I've heard some people say, well, just set them in a pan of water.
Mm-hmm.
Is that effective or is that going to cause a problem?
it is effective. What's kind of going on there is you would think kind of this is the opposite of the way water would travel. That water would travel down through soil, but that water that travels down through soil is called gravitational water. When we water a flat or a pot, the water runs down through and comes out the bottom if there's excess, and that's the gravitational, which is also another reason why you want to make sure you have holes in your pots.
In the bottom of your pots, yeah, right, yeah.
For folks that may want to use other containers that weren't necessarily for, like a yogurt container or something like that, you want to make sure there's a way for that extra water to get out. But there's a second type of water in the soil called capillary water. And that's what happens basically when you take a sponge and lay it onto the counter and a little bit of water, and it'll suck it right up. And it's because there's these little channels in the sponge and little channels in the soil the same way, and that water will be pulled up even though it's against gravity. So that's what's happening in that tray when you set it in the tray of water, the seedlings. On a really cloudy day, you might not want to set that up, but certainly on a hot sunny day.
On a hot sunny day, if you can't be there during that stretch of time.
Yep. Then there are other more complicated ways of actually misting waterers that can be set up automatically over seedlings so that every so many minutes it'll come on, or I've seen some in some cases that have these little paddles, and when the mist comes on, the paddle gets heavy and drops down, shuts off the water, and as it dries, it rises back up and the water comes on again. It's pretty
cool.
Slick little idea. But, you know, that can get expensive too.
Yeah, this is a home scale here.
Yeah, exactly. So. The other thing to be concerned about, and I've started a lot of seedlings in the past in windows of the house, and that's actually a pretty good way to go. You will see the plants kind of lean over trying to get into the sun, and they'll get what we call leggy, just a little, the stems get a little elongated. And so you want to, when you begin to have those seedlings starting to grow, you want to be able to rotate those flats enough so that you can kind of get them leaning the other way as well to get some balance.
You're listening to WERU, and this is Common Ground, hosted by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. Our topic of conversation this morning is seedlings, and it's not too late to start your seeds. And I'm joined in the studio with Andrew Marshall and Dave Colson, two of our excellent farmers and staff here at MOFCA. And we'd be happy to have a conversation with you if you'd like to call in with some questions or comments. The number here at the studio is 469-0500. And again, this is Common Ground here on your community radio station, WERU-FM. So what else do we have for this kind of cloudy weather that could be a problem besides the damping off? I guess we actually have a caller. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Mavis from Sullivan.
Oh, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Yeah, great time for the show. I wanted to make a comment about damping off.
Mm-hmm.
There's this tea that can really help when your seedlings are going. It's made from nettle and chamomile, and it actually stops the damping off.
That's great.
Oh, thank you very much. And how do you make it?
You make it like you'd make any tea. You boil some water and put some of the herb in. I don't think much about quantity. I also want to just comment that I do make my own mix from my own soil and my own compost, and I do use some ProMix in it. But I don't have any trouble with diseases and so on. Maybe my soil is just specially blessed.
Well, that's a great point. And the idea here with the application of any sort of organically derived materials, teas made from various things is both kind of an active inoculation of the soil with other critters that will have beneficial properties, and also just sort of the principle of occupying ecological niches in that soil, right? So the idea that if the soil is sort of barren of good critters, then the bad critters will dominate. But if you have enough good critters in there, they're just going to crowd them out and balance them out. So,
yeah, I think of the compost as good medicine for them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, great. Well, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. So, yes. So, what else besides the damping out? What other types of challenges are we seeing? Or this kind of a growing season, particularly this past week or two, has just been miserable.
Yeah, I think you know, we're talking about kind of people biding their time, people chomping at the bit to want to really set stuff out in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they started things a few weeks ago, and things are getting maybe a little leggy or a little pot bound, and so obviously, timing of setting things out in the garden needs to be really taken into account. And so some of the issues with setting plants out either when the weather's not right or the plants aren't ready are, Dave?
Well, it must be soil temperature, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, first off, plants don't really metabolize below 40 degrees. So If the air and soil temperatures is 40 degrees or close to it, which we've kind of had around 45 degrees, and the soil's not been that warm, you can get those plants out, but they'll really just sit there waiting for better growing conditions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's where having some kind of covers, either a cold frame or a hoop frame of some kind, greenhouse, somewhere for those early seedlings to go out into will really help. But in the field at this point, we, for instance, do a lot of our onions from seeds instead of buying the sets, because we get a little bit more variety of on the onions. Now, onions are more like an 8-week time frame to get them started and into the ground. And onions at this point in time would not really be something I would suggest that you start from seed now, just because of that time frame.
Well, I think we have a caller on the line.
Hi, yes. This is Dave from Camden.
Good morning.
Hi. Good timing for this show. I feel a little late on starting my seeds, but I'm getting going, and you're helping me doing it. Here's a really funny thing. Maybe I'm impatient, but I'm using one of these Jiffy Mix kind of seed starting mixtures out of a bag, and also another one that where it's already in the plastic compartmentalized six packs.
Yep.
So I've got two different kinds of things going here, and they're slightly different in their composition, but they both seem to have a lot of perlite, and they both seem to have a lot of sphagnum. And I don't know if any of them have any actual soil, but I can't get. Well, how do you get these? How do you get these mixtures to absorb water? You know,
they tend
to create this sort of surface tension, and the water just doesn't seem to want to mix into these little guys.
That's right.
Okay, so I'll hang up, okay?
Oh, thanks for your call.
So I was talking about these two types of water, the gravity and then the capillary, and the one that I didn't mention is the one that Dave is talking about here, is called... now I'm going to forget it since I'm trying to think of it, is a hygroscopic water. And what happens to soil, this happens to your soil out in the field, the same way it happens to a seedling mix or seed mix, soil mix, is that each particle of soil is coated with a small amount of moisture on it. And this isn't moisture that will gravitationally come out. It isn't moisture that you could squeeze out like a sponge. It's very subtle coating of the soil particles. And once soil dries out excessively, either because it's too hot and dry outside or you've bought a soil mix that needs to be moistened, is that there's actually friction between the water itself and the soil particles so that the water can't slip between the soil particles. And what you may have seen in starting your seedlings is you have this nice mix. You've put your seed in there. You put some water on top. You come back an hour later, and basically it's only penetrated an eighth of an inch or something into your pot. And that's that loss of that hygroscopic water. So what we do whenever we get ready to start new mix, and this doesn't really do you any good when it's already in the trays, but we put our mix into a wheelbarrow and add water and kind of get the mix to the moisture that we're looking for first. Now in your trays that already have or pots that already have soil in them, what you might want to do is before you start the seed, spend a day or two wetting them or put them into the tray of water, as Cheryl was mentioning. Some way of getting them moist first so that you you have a way of kind of getting more water on there than maybe you would do as a seedling.
Well, that's a good point. So basically you maybe water them from the top and water them from the bottom and get them the right moisture content before you even put the seed in, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And we do that by mixing it in the wheelbarrow first.
Super. I think we actually have another caller on the line. Good morning. No. Hello. No. I guess we might have. I guess we've lost them. So, you're listening to WERU, and we've had quite an interesting discussion this morning about seedlings, and whether it's too late to start, and no, it's not, and what kind of conditions we need when we're going to put them outside. I guess we were speaking about that the soil temperature really isn't, I don't think it's quite there yet, is it?
No, it's not there yet. And the other big shock for seedlings when they're ready to go out is they've been in this, either in your house or in maybe a heated space of some type or a greenhouse, and suddenly we're putting them out into these cold temperatures, and they need some kind of space between the warm place where they're started and the cold outside.
And before we go on to that, is that called hardening off, by
it
the
is.
Way?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Before
it.
We go to that, I think we do have a caller on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. Could you state your name and where you're calling from, please?
I'm calling from Penobscot.
Yes.
And I'd like to know what to do about slugs and snails. Now, snails I've only seen in the last 10 years with the shelled snails.
Uh-huh.
I'd never seen those before. I grew up here, but the slugs have always been here. But I'd just like to know what to do about them.
So would these be in your seedling trays, or this is out in the garden?
Out in the garden.
Yep.
Yeah, and I'll take my answer out there.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling.
Where we grow, we're very much in the open with field area and so on, and I haven't really found them to be too difficult a problem for us. Of course, anyone that's using a mulch of some kind or your garden is close to woods or natural areas, that's where they're going to be coming from. There are some tricks. There are some products. There's one product called diatomaceous earth that's actually the dead bodies of these diatoms that live in the ocean. And they once they die, they do have kind of a crusty shell around the diatom, and they're sharp. And when you sprinkle this around areas of the garden as the slug or snail crawls over it, it pierces them and will help to control them. Of course, it's another product to buy. So another way to go about it would be actually to look at an area that you are thinking they might be coming from and place a board down on the ground, an old piece of wood or board, and then check underneath that often enough, they will tend to congregate underneath there. Typically, slugs and snails don't like hot and dry, so during the daytime, they'll find something cool and damp to get underneath to protect themselves, and that's when you can kind of trap them.
I go out and hand pick them.
Yep.
I mean, obviously I have a small area and I don't have a big field, but that's the reason is I got the woods all around it. And I used to stomp on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read, and you could tell me if this is correct, that even if I stomped on them, those eggs would still hatch.
Oh, huh.
So now I put them in a jar, yep. And I close up the jar and keep collecting them, and then I throw them away. I hate slugs, but they're kind of slimy. There is a product, and I bet it has a domaceous earth in it. It's called Sluggo,
right.
That I've seen that you can sprinkle. Is that the same?
That's actually the active ingredient. That is iron phosphate.
Mm-hmm.
Which it's ingested by the slug and it's toxic.
Uh-oh.
But it also has a bait. But that you, so.
All right. I think we have another caller on the line. Good morning. Could you state your name and where you're calling from, please?
This is Beatty from Camden. I got all inspired about the watering thing. And I don't know if you can get these anymore, but we have a system of planting seedlings in this area that we got from Mary Gardens in Camden. They just did all kinds of neat things. And you could get these little nozzles that people would use for dampening clothes if you were ironing before they were steam irons. And I think you can still get these things, and you put them in a bottle that's maybe a flexible plastic bottle, and you kind of squeeze the bottle so that you get a nice, not too hard spray of water. And when you have a little seedling thing that you haven't maybe dampened enough, you just kind of squirt this, and it's just the right amount of mm-hmm. force that you don't disturb the seeds in the newly planted little pot. And there was a whole, so that's sort of what I use if I don't have the soil mixture dampened enough the way it was described on your program, you know, just to get it damp enough. Oh. The other thing that they always did was you'd start whatever each category of seed in a very small pot, and you put it in a plastic bag with a little chimney at the top with a rubber band around it so the air can get in, and then that goes in a warm place.
Mm-hmm.
You have just a tray of them. You can get all your seeds started that way. And somebody was just saying that she is having really good luck with just the light of the oven. They germinated much faster.
Oh, great.
And then transplant them into packs.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go under a light for a while in the window because there's really not enough light. And then they go out in the porch on shelves in the sun porch. And then they go on a trays that go in and out, gardening off. And then they go in the garden.
You've got a great system going there.
Yeah, but it's partly from Mary Spring, which was such a great nursery. And they had all these systems and they taught us.
That's
super.
Great.
Well, thank
anyway,
you.
Anyway, that's it.
Thanks
so much for calling in, Katie. And I do believe we have another caller on the line. Good morning. Could you state your name and where you're calling from, please?
Howdy, Skip from industry.
Good morning.
I can't believe nobody said anything about beer traps.
Well, from what I understand, that was the cutworms that were doing or making people believe that the beer would work for the slugs. So that the slugs were drunk most of the time and the cutworms wouldn't have as much competition.
Oh, they usually drowned in the beer.
Oh, they
That's
did.
Right.
There
yep.
you go.
Yep.
So
have you used that technique?
Oh, yeah. I thought that was the only way to go.
Yep.
And
it's so convenient after gym night. You run around and grab all the bottles with a mouthful left in the bottom and pour them all into a container.
Oh, shoot.
Well, that's great.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for bringing that one up.
That's a good one.
The slugs in your garden must be psyched for Sunday morning then, huh?
Yeah, right. Oh, shoot. We have another caller on the line. Good morning. Can you state your name and where you're calling from, please?
Good morning. This is Yo in Tremont.
Hey, Yo. How you doing?
Fine, thanks. Slugs can be really destructive, particularly on a damp day like today.
Hmm.
I just thought I'd share my particular method for dealing with slugs. In relation to the problem of having a garden surrounded by woods, I'm surrounded by woods here too, but my garden's in the middle of a grassy area, and I have ducks.
Ah.
So any slug who wants to get at my lettuce has got to cross a no man's land of ducks. And the other thing I do is I go out in the morning. I just did this, as a matter of fact. Any slugs I do see, I pop them into a can with a little flour or cornmeal, and they curl up, yep. And boy, don't ducks love breaded slugs.
Oh, you're so good to your ducks.
Thank you so much for putting on this show, and thank you to everyone for supporting Community Radio.
Oh, thanks for your call. I never thought of that, a breaded slug for your ducks. Now that's a good one. So
you put the beer in the garden and then get the slugs to go for it, and then they have to go through the gauntlet of the ducks.
I don't know
if I want to be a slug anymore.
Oh, shoot. All right, so I want to just get back and finish off on the actual setting. We've made our seedlings. We're going to set them out, and we talked about the process of hardening off.
Yep. Yeah. So that's where a cold frame of some kind mm-hmm. can be really helpful. And actually, one of the callers brought up with lights, something else I wanted to mention is that folks have been using these grow lights, buying the grow light bulbs to mm-hmm. help with the seedlings. And actually, a kind of a cheaper, easier way to go about that is the fluorescent tubes that you can get now. There's the white spectrum and the yellow spectrum. So if you have a two-tube light fixture, and you can put one of each into that light fixture, it's basically about the equivalent of a grow light.
Oh, yep. Super. I think we actually have a couple more callers, and then we're going to wrap up. Good morning. Can you state your name and where you're calling from, please?
Yes, this is Barbara, and I'm in Belfast.
Good morning.
I used to think that slugs were really a bad joke played on us gardeners. But when I did the composter course through the cooperative extension, they said, put them in your compost pile. They'd be happy forever there because they're decomposers.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some really interesting pictures because when I would eat a grapefruit, I would put some of that tanglefoot inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And honest to God, I have a picture of two grapefruit halves. And it looked like somebody put those slugs on there exactly a half an inch apart all around, very symmetrical. And they would, like, nibble on the edge, and then they'd slide in, and they couldn't get back out of the tanglefoot.
Well, there you go.
But if you put them, you know, I just take a quart yogurt container, and, you know, when you pull the outside leaves off your cabbage because the flea beetles have got them, you know, that's a good trap. And then just put them all in a container and take them up and throw them in your compost, and they stay there. They're happy there.
Oh, super.
So,
well,
that's
thanks.
About all I have to say.
Thanks
it's
for calling.
Show. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Barbara. And I think we have one more caller on the line. Good morning. Could you state your name and where you're calling from?
Hi, this is Jean from Belfast.
Great.
Let me turn off my radio. I have two quick tips. One is I used to have chickens, and they wouldn't eat slugs unless they were coated with cornmeal. Then they loved them. Mm-hmm. So that's in addition to ducks. And with sprinkling the seedlings, I gave up looking for the ironing sprinkler. And you just get any soda bottle or juice bottle or orange juice or, you know, some kind of flexible plastic bottle. Poke a hole in several holes in the top with a nail or a drill, and you're ready to go.
Oh, super. Cool.
And here's my question. I have had variable success with seedlings. Some years, gangbusters. Other years, terrible because of the weather and my room that I can grow in. And then later in the year, since I have big windows, the sun is overhead and it doesn't shine on the seedlings anymore. So my question is the opposite. What plants can you direct seed that, you know, when I moved to Maine, I thought you had to start everything in seedlings, but maybe can you direct seed some things like later vegetables, even squashes? I don't know. So to avoid having to start everything with seedlings.
Well, super. Thanks for your call. We'll try to get that answer in.
Yeah, pretty much a lot of these things that we're starting in trays will start outside. Obviously, the peas and beans, squash, certainly, cucumbers, melons, spinach, turnips, any of the broccoli, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, even lettuces. A lot of them can be started outdoors. Of course, they're really small and take a lot of care in that early stage and or more susceptible, but certainly can be done.
Oh, great. Well, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. Andrew, what's coming up down the pike? Do we have anything else exciting in the state?
Yeah, so growing season's approaching, so the event season is kind of winding down, but we got a pretty much something happening every weekend in May here, and I think we're a little pressed for time, so I'm not going to go through everything, but check out mofca.org.
Yeah,
where there's a pretty comprehensive calendar.
Yeah, we have a lot of activities going on still at the Common Ground. I know next month our show here on WERU, your community radio, will be June 1st, and we're going to talk about local spirits and local beverages. So that should be a very entertaining show. And again, this is Cheryl Wixon with Maine Organic Farmers. I want to thank Andrew Marshall and Dave Colson for joining me in the studio
to have a very
nice conversation on seedlings. And until next month, we look forward to speaking again. Thanks so much.